This is Sphinx Radio, exploring the enigmas of the ages and the puzzles of the present, with your host, William H. Kennedy.
Philip Collins and David Collins, welcome to Sphinx Radio.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Bill.
Now, you two wrote a book called The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, an examination of the epistemic aristocracy from the 19th to the 21st century. Now, usually when you hear something like science, you usually think of very good things like cancer treatments and, you know, flying to Mars and very positive and upbeat things. But your book, which I highly recommend, I read it myself, by the way, your book has a very different view of science. And would you explain what you mean by a scientific dictatorship?
Sure. Well, actually, the term was coined by Aldous Huxley in the book Brave New World Revisited. And for the benefit of the listening audience, I'll just read the entire quote for them.
Very good.
Quote, "The older dictators fell because they could never supply their subjects with enough bread, enough circuses, enough miracles, and mysteries. Under a scientific dictatorship, education will really work, with the result that most men and women will grow up to love their servitude and will never dream of revolution. There seems to be no good reason why a thoroughly scientific dictatorship should ever be overthrown," unquote.
Wow, that's a very heavy statement from Aldous Huxley. So just to really give you what I see in that. So the bread and circus are the entertainment and the things of science and technology that we receive and enjoy are actually used by the people on the top of our economic and political power structure to control and possess us rather than to liberate us. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, that would be a very fair statement. Basically, what we're dealing with here is what Paul and I call an epistemological cartel. Epistemology, for those who are not familiar with philosophy, epistemology is basically the study of knowledge. It's derived from the original Greek root episteme, which means knowing. To give you a little background on how far back epistemological cartels stretched throughout human history, as we move backwards in history, we find that the power elites, whether it was the elites of Babylon or Egypt or any number of the other ancient oligarchies, were able to maintain a system of control, manipulation, and strict regimentation, the establishment of their day, if you will, through religious institutions and mysticism. Now, these institutions, these religious institutions and these mystical institutions were basically epistemological cartels. They held basically a monopoly on knowledge based on their alleged communion with suprasensible entities. Now, that that entire dynamic would shift as the 19th century gave way to the 20th century. It would kind of invert itself. The epistemological cartels would then premise their ostensible epistemological primacy upon their upon their rejection of suprasensible entities, and would basically hold that all knowledge and all legitimate knowledge had to be derived on this ontological plane of existence, and had to basically reject the concepts of transcendent God, spirit realm, what have you. It's now it's more materialistic. It's more radically empirical. It's now basically, again, confined to this ontological plane of existence.
What essentially was happening was that the mystical forms of manipulation started to lose their effectiveness. They had basically strained credulity to the point of breaking, and so the elite put their theocratic power structure through a kind of epistemic overhaul, and the whole thing went through what can only be described as an epistemic transformation, and the result was the emergence of this concept of a scientific dictatorship. And the philosophical underpinnings and foundations of the power elite's religion, if you will, stay intact, but they assume more of a secular and scientific appearance. We owe this primarily to Darwin, whose evolutionary theory was used to scientifically legitimate the thinking of several individuals that you could describe as theoreticians for the power elite. To name a few off the top of my head, Adam Weishaupt of the Illuminati infamy, Karl Marx, Voltaire, Diderot, Rousseau, and the list goes on and on. But Darwinism was used to micromanage this crusade for a scientific dictatorship.
Now, that's quite an interesting statement you made about Darwin. Now, would you see something like Hitler's Nazi science, wherein he used Darwinism to justify the murder of undesirable people, first of all, disabled and mentally challenged people, and later on different racial groups he didn't particularly like Jews and Gypsies, as being genetically inferior. Now, would you say that would be a form of scientific dictatorship?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, an evolutionist himself, Sir Arthur Keith, said that no one had done more to make Germany conform to the principles of evolution and evolutionary theory than Hitler himself. Basically, the science, Hitler's race science, was evolutionary in character. It basically held that man was going through a hierarchy of progressive biological development, and that would arrive at a developmental capstone. And at that developmental capstone, you would have basically the emergence of the mythical Aryan, who, by the way, Darwin was, Hitler was basically inculcated and basically taught all that he knew about social Darwinism by an evolutionist named Ernest Haeckel. And Haeckel himself said that the Aryan, and I'm quoting him directly, exhibited, quote, symmetry of all parts and that equal development which we call the type of perfect human beauty, unquote. Well, such thinking would spawn the eugenics movement, which was the crusade to genetically manufacture a God-man who would be the new object of humanity's worship. But you have this this common theme seems to reemerge throughout other socialist totalitarian forms of government. For instance, in communist Russia, you had basically the belief in the emergence of an evolutionary Soviet man, what they called the Soviet man, which was their counterpart to the Nazis' Aryan. But that's basically the overall consequence of evolutionary thinking, is this belief in this hierarchical developmental framework that humanity is presently ascending through.
Now, when you consider things like, though Christianity has its flaws, and you can go on forever about the injustices that, Christianity has inflicted upon the world, but on the other hand, there is also something dignifying about Christianity, despite all the mistakes. And when you have a metaphysical component to viewing humanity, I think it sort of gives a great degree of dignity to people, unlike this, very harsh scientific worldview, where ultimately you're just seen as a good or bad mechanism of the state, and when you put the state first, you're always going to get into that sort of thinking. And there again, I'm not, hiding from the problems. I'm a Roman Catholic, and we have lots of problems in our church at the moment with pedophiles and people gone wrong. But on the whole, when you look at the two worldviews, I've always felt that the scientific worldview, especially in the 20th century, has caused much more destruction, just in number of human lives, than previous Christian and other spiritual systems. How would you respond to that?
You're absolutely correct there. The body count with these different regimes that base their ideological foundation was based on humanism and on the idea of a scientific dictatorship being the perfect form of government. They racked up a much larger body count than any theocratic power structure prior. what happens is that you get a flip flop with these more secular regimes that we see in the 20th century. With the older order, we had this idea of God being in the beginning, and the good thing about that was that God created it all. God created man. Man is a unique creature because he's made in the image of God, and so there's a uniqueness to him. There's purpose.
Yes. It's a balance. It strikes a balance because while man retains his unique position as imago viva dei, created in the image of the Creator, it at the same time avoids the pitfalls of anthropocentric hubris. Man is not the center of all things. It's theocentric because it remains God-centered.
Now the problem is that with the secular regimes, what happened? Like I said, there was a flip-flop. The cart was put before the horse, so to speak, where there all of a sudden wasn't a God in the beginning, but, however, through scientific advancement, there could be a God in the end. That's why when I want to throw students of philosophy for a loop, I tell them that atheism is not a belief, a non-belief in deity. It is instead a belief in emergent deity, because what it's basically a belief in is that there was no God in the beginning, but through human reason, through science, there can be man, humanity in toto can become God in the end. We can reach a state of apotheosis, and that crusade to create a God-man has just brought untold atrocities forward in history. All the different crusades to weed out the so-called inferiors to get to this perfect person has just—I mean, like the body count is unbelievable.
Oh, I know. Especially when you—and just to inform our listeners, we're talking about people who subscribe to this worldview. We're talking about people like Mao Tse-tung, Pol Pot, Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler. These are people who butchered, you know, countless amounts of human beings with this bizarre belief that for a global utopia to emerge, there must be this great period of destruction and murder. And as you say, ultimately, it's to create a godlike Superman. And you see this all over in science. Like, you have this whole life extension movement that, you know, you can live forever here and now if you take certain hormones and certain supplements and certain things. And, you know, they're saying now 40 is the new 30. So you do have the same aspirations of religion, of, you know, immortality and peace, but they offer it through materialist means. And the hook and the bait, from what I've seen anyway, is that they also have this underlying belief in that in order to have anything good, you must have this massive destruction of inferior people.
You're absolutely right there. And the destructive component of this belief system is very, very important to look at, because as a result of the epistemic transformation that we talked about at the beginning of this discussion, one of the results of that epistemic transformation was a much more vicious breed of power elite. The new breed of power elite can be described as a socio-political Darwinian. Of course, Malachi Martin spoke about the socio-political Darwinian at length in his book, Windswept House. But the socio-political Darwinians are globalists who believe that political and economic and social interdependence is the result of evolution, and that interdependence is one of evolution's progressive functions, and they believe that Darwin's theory doesn't just apply to the physical origins of mankind, but it also applies to nations, and it applies to socio-political arrangements. But that brings us to the topic of warfare, because as long as we have a socio-political Darwinian elite dominating the affairs of men, we can expect to experience a climate of perpetual warfare. In his book, The Power Elite, sociologist Ewright Mills tells us that the power elite direct the military establishment, and the power elite, as a result, make sure that key positions in the military establishment are occupied by Darwinian militarists, And Darwinian militarists believe that the universal biological laws have ruled war an inevitability. War is a necessary competition between humans that leads to biological adaptation and progress, and you can't remove war from human society, and you can expect humanity to reach evolution, its evolutionary end, which is a God-man, only through war. William Graham Sumner, a very famous sociologist, put it this way. He said, quote, "It is the Darwinian competition for life which makes war, and that is why war has always existed and always will." So all those peace activists out there who feel they're simply banging their heads up against the wall at this particular period of time, consider this. These guys are essentially evolutionary Calvinists, if you will. The Darwinian militarists believe that war is biologically determined, and biological processes predetermined that we were going to fight one another, and so human free will is obliterated in a Darwinian militarist mind. So you can forget it. You can't choose peace. War is in your genes. But you can manage the process from their perspective. And so what you get is these individuals who believe that they can consciously guide evolution, and they do so by engineering conflicts. And if you look at most of the wars during the last century and going into the 21st century, most of them were consciously managed and created by the power elite, and that's been proven over and over again.
Well, yeah, wars begin in the minds of men, as they say.
Absolutely, absolutely.
To give you an idea of how war is pretty much intrinsic to Darwinian framework of things, and now political science, having been subsumed under Darwinism, is now predisposed to perpetual war. Darwinism exhibits a distinctly Hegelian framework. It's very dialectical in nature. You have the species, which is your thesis, coming into conflict with the environment or another species, which is your antithesis. And this conflict between the two basically results in a synthesis, which is a newly enhanced, more highly evolved species. Now, you see this dialectical framework tangibly enacted in, for instance, communism. Communism had the dialectic of the proletariat against the bourgeoisie, which, of course, was supposed to synthesize in the Marxist utopian, stateless paradise, which, of course, never did happen. You also have this framework exhibited in Nazi Germany. The German, which was the thesis, was pitted against the Jew, which was the antithesis, and the resulting newly emergent species that Hitler believed would be created from that conflict would be the Aryan. But that's how this pretty much works. Because everything, all political science and socio-political arrangements and what have you, have been subsumed under evolutionary theory, now it's all pretty much predisposed to ongoing perpetual conflict.
We even see it with today's modern elites. For instance, Samuel P. Huntington of the Trilateral Commission fame, he wrote a book called Clash of Civilizations.
Right, very famous book, yeah.
Yes, very much so, where he said that it was inevitable that the West was going to clash with the Muslim world. And the end result of that was going to be an American empire that would eventually fold into a world government, and that's where the neoconservative faction of the elite basically have gotten their current battle plan for dominance. And lo and behold, that's exactly what has happened. It's
a self-fulfilling prophecy, really.
Absolutely.
Exactly, because if you in the book we point this out, that the whole war on terrorism was manufactured. That's not to say that the terrorism itself is phony, but the war against it is. And we go into the fact that former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski was key in creating the terrorist threat. They basically began supplying the Mujahideen in Afghanistan prior to the Soviet invasion to entice the Soviets to invade Afghanistan. And then when the Soviets invaded, they used that as a pretext for radicalizing the population there with textbooks that were filled with a form of Islam that was very violent and had been dormant in the Muslim world for quite some time. And then they used Afghanistan as a launching point for this new violent form of Islam that reached most of the Arab world and most of the Middle East.
So you see that Hegelian dialectic emerging its ugly head once more.
Absolutely.
Now, what's interesting about the Hegelian dialectic is you can actually see it in occult literature. Isaac Luria, for example.
Absolutely.
And you see this really coming out of the diabolical, alchemical, Masonic cult. That's where that three-phase element comes from. I don't know exactly where Hegel got it, but that's where the idea originates.
Well, very interestingly enough, Hegel's a good bit of Hegel's early work was influenced by a Gnostic Kabbalist named Christoph Oettinger.
Oh, right, yeah.
And if you look at early communism and Nazism and what have you, you have there basically a form of secular Gnosticism, because their socio-political utopianism, basically what it did was it eviscerated all the metaphysical contents of Gnosticism and relocated the Gnostic mandate to immanentize the eschaton to this ontological plane of existence, to the physical universe. So their gnosis became science, and the idea of altering man's sensate being and achieving apotheosis or deification was embodied in their campaigns to basically erect the absolute state and totalitarian man underneath it.
Very good. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Okay, we are back with Philip Collins and Paul Collins. I take it you're the older brother, Philip.
Actually, we're both twins.
Oh, you're twins. I didn't realize that. Well, one of you still has to be older, but I won't ask.
I'm 5 minutes older than Philip.
Oh, okay. Well, you're very egalitarian. Good for you. kind of like our people. Okay, just to get back to what we were saying, now this emergence of the scientific method and this Hegelian thinking, which is applied to really everything, is there any occultism? You certainly see this, of course, with the more obvious example of Hitler's Germany. They kind of mixed occultism with this, especially Himmler. But do you see any of this in the great dictators of the communist world?
Well, I think that with Lenin you see a lot of the Gnosticism. And of course he was very much instrumental in bringing communism to power in Russia.
Yes, the revolutionaries of Lenin's time, as a matter of fact, according to James H. Billington, who wrote the excellent book, The Fire in the Minds of Men, the early revolutionaries adhered to what was called the Promethean faith. And Prometheus is basically a pagan motif. It's a paganized version of the account of Lucifer's fall from heaven. And Lucifer, to the modern socio-political Darwinian elite, Lucifer, while he may not be a literal metaphysical entity, embodies all the principles to which they adhere. And that's the belief system is known as Luciferianism. It was also disseminated on the popular level during the Enlightenment and now today as secular humanism.
Now, Karl Marx as a young man was involved in Luciferianism as well.
Well, as a matter of fact, many people believe that his long, thick beard and his long hair, he had grown out as a tribute to Joanna Southcott, who was a satanic witch, as I understand it. And many of his old poems make allusions to the adversary, to the devil, and see him as kind of a liberating kind of a personality, as opposed to a personality of evil that we get in the Abrahamic faiths of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam.
That's quite amazing when you consider that one thing you always hear from secularists and communists and even socialists is that a lot of their leaderships and people who form their theory are devoid of metaphysical beliefs. Well, it's not really true when you look very closely. It's there. It's just not apparent.
Absolutely. Well, it's also interesting that Darwinism itself, Darwinism and evolutionary theory, it basically holds aloft the theory of abiogenesis, or basically spontaneous generation, and that life just non-living matter all of a sudden somehow became living and became sentient. Well, this is this claim is basically that living things really created themselves, and that is essentially a metaphysical claim. And metaphysical claims, of course, were initially the providence of religion. So, really, the doctrine of Darwinism and evolutionary theory is really a religious in character itself.
It's also that just a retelling of that Gnostic belief in self-creation and self-salvation, because we have those two ideas in Gnosticism as well.
Yes, in essence, Darwinism actually functions as a Gnostic myth.
Wow, it's very much the sin of Eve when Lucifer said, "You shall be as gods."
Absolutely.
You know, it's the same promise, and as I say, you see it, it especially spooks me a bit, because it's even, as I mentioned earlier, fallen into the very, very common realm of understanding, and especially, as I say, with life extension things. You know, they always use science. This is scientifically proven. This is scientifically backed. This is based on scientific trials. You can blah, blah, blah. And you see on TV things like they'll have all these bionic limbs and bionic hearts, and, you know, you can expect to live to be at least 120, probably more. It's all these same promises that were made just in a scientific technological purview, and I find them much more dangerous when they're couched in these sorts of terms personally.
Absolutely. Well, and also, for instance, to give you one very specific example, you have the transhumanist movement. And the transhumanist movement basically holds that through biotechnology, cybernetics, genetic engineering, nanotechnology, that essentially what will happen is man will eventually realize the Nietzschean mandate that was placed forward in Thus Spake Zarathustra, that man would be overcome by the overman. And this is a very it's a very anti-human doctrine. It's also very very Gnostic, because Gnosticism, of course, derides the human condition and basically holds that our humanity is basically a prison, and that the entire physical universe is basically hell, and that we're fettered by the demonic agents of time and space, and thus we must overcome our own humanity through gnosis. And in transhumanism, you have this idea of the post-human condition, the point at which humanity ceases to be humanity, it becomes something else, which is basically God. To give you an example of how the thinking works, Bart Kosko, who's a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Southern California, he espoused a core precept of transhumanist doctrine when he said, and I'm quoting him directly now, quote, biology is not destiny. It was just nature's first quick and dirty way to compute with meat. Chips are destiny, unquote. Now, in this transhumanist context, our biological condition as humans is analogous to hell, and technology is the instrument by which they can immanentize the eschaton. They can create heaven on earth. transhumanism's characteristic Gnosticism probably owes itself to the movement's Darwinian premises. The movement is heavily premised on Darwinism, on evolution, although they've kind of rejected the anti-human elements of early Darwinism, which held that we were not at the center of things. Now they've basically taken on this anthropocentric hubris, where they believe man is the center of all things, but only in that he has the potential to cease being man. He has the potential to become God.
Wow, you see that really in all sorts of things, like the New Age movement, and I really gave a really close look at the Human Potential movement when I did my MA out at San Francisco State, because that's where a lot of this sorts of things are based, and I used to go to things like the Whole Life Expo, and the Whole Life Expo, that's an interesting thing to go look at sometimes, because it backs up everything you're saying. You know that if you do certain things, you will become godlike. If you eat certain foods, you will be immortal. It's all these same sorts of promises you see over and over again, but they are ultimately they're devoid of moral value, because you're putting yourself you're pitting yourself against other human beings ultimately, and that's one thing that certainly does lead to violence.
Yeah, there's a real thin line that's drawn, and it's all right to have the mindset of Jack LaLanne, because God knows I'd want to be that fit at 91 years of age myself. But there's a thin line between what he's saying, you know, living out a full life and a healthy life simultaneously, and then saying that you're going to transcend being human and the whole condition of being mortal altogether by reaching the throne room of God and pushing him off the throne and taking up residence there.
Absolutely.
Well, I wouldn't accuse Jack LaLanne of that, which I know you didn't.
No.
But he said that he can't die because it would be bad for his image, which is a different different thing altogether.
That's what I'm saying. You have to differentiate between these folks that basically they push for a long, healthy life. But they're certainly not looking for immortality by any stretch of the imagination. And then these other individuals, like Ray Kurzweil, who takes 125, I believe, vitamin supplements a day, in the hopes that he's going to live long enough to where technology reaches the point where it will make humanity immortal.
Yes, to draw the distinction, I think that the distinction is to be made between the anthropocentric view and the theocentric view. The anthropocentric view holds that, you know, we will eventually achieve immortality because of our own cognitive powers acting as the chief facilitators of our own salvation. Whereas the theocentric view holds that, you know, man has the potential for glory, has the potential for greatness, but only as long as he remains at the center of God's will. And it's pretty much summed up in the words of Jesus Christ himself when Jesus said, "I have come that you might have life and have it more abundantly." Jesus was the source of life. Jesus being God incarnate was the source of life, not biotechnology or cybernetics, not the latest magic elixirs that the medical science establishment, that the pharmacological industry develops. It's basically when man is at the center of God's will that man can actually, you know, achieve these greater things, and that's the distinction to be drawn.
Right. Well, we're just a bit out of time. Could you give us your web address and how we could purchase your book, please?
Oh, sure. Well, we have a website at Conspiracy Archive. That's www.conspiracyarchive.com. You just click the commentary link, and there's a list of the people that write for Conspiracy Archive, and you'll find Paul and Philip Collins there, and you just click that link. And our book is available through Amazon.com, through BookSurge.com. That's BookSurge, all one word, .com, and should also be available eventually through BarnesandNoble.com.
Right. Just one more time. It's The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship by Philip Collins and Paul Collins. And I'd like to thank both you guys for coming on the show. I'll have you back again. We share a lot of common ideas, and I really enjoy talking to you. And thank you for being on Sphinx Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Very good.